Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you, coming to you live from the Kintec Studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. You can text in 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. And I have the absolute pleasure of hosting the final show of the 2024-25 season with Thomas Drantz on Canucks Talk. His final show for the summer. Drantz, how are you?
I'm doing well, Josh. Yeah, good to be doing this show with you before a lengthy 2.5+ months off. Maybe more. We'll see. We always like to end the season with cliffhangers.
Yeah. Leave them wanting more, and hopefully do get more.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And, you know, reflecting on this season and where we've got to in the wake of, you know, what occurred on July 1 and the Besser extension and Garland and Demko extending and the Kane trade, Pew Suter's departure, the still ongoing search for a 2C. You know, this was a uniquely challenging Canucks season to cover, I think. And you could sort of smell it as the team's performance listed in November, that there was just something off. And obviously we know how it all went down. I don't know that we know still some of the key specifics. And so, you know, in that limited information environment, right, you're beginning to, and I think the Besser extension, the fact that he didn't leave has really buoyed this perception, this idea that, you know, that's in the past, that the vibes have changed, that this group is committed, that Adam Foote, you know, has sat down with Pettersson and Hughes and Demko, did so in Detroit. Ian McIntyre's got a great article about it right now up at sportsnet.ca. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this team is being given over to this core to run with. And isn't this the same story when Boudreaux took over, right? Like, isn't this the same story that we've told ourselves before? The vibes are different. The team's being turned over to the core.
You're and so, a month removed from the season, and you're like, okay, you know what? Fresh start for everyone. It does feel like we do this often with the Vancouver Canucks.
This is the fourth time we've done it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think fundamentally, it's just a proof. Is it going to be in the pudding? You know, like the proof is going to be, and the burden of proof needs to be on this group, right? They have not demonstrated collectively the ability to be a consistent playoff team, much less a contender. And I think that's a fair place for us to start in terms of captioning what we've seen, you know, signing off for the summer. I don't want to, like, predict what's going to happen because I think this Canucks roster is still very much a work in progress. I want to see what training camp looks like. I think there are reasons to be hopeful about what Adam Foote can do as the head coach of this team. I think there are reasons to be skeptical. I think there are obvious reasons to look at this lineup and think, man, there's real fragility at some very high leverage positions. Excuse me. But there's also reasons to look at this roster and say, hey, this team should at least be able to control play really well. And we'll see if they are able to get the goaltending and have enough finish and be good enough on special teams to make that defensive solidity, certainly the back end solidity, you know, stand up. So I'm just sort of grappling with what we've been through across the last 12 months.
Yeah.
And trying to think through, like, what's going to be the major storylines when I'm back? And, you know, the sort of evergreen question of is this a playoff team will loom large, I'm sure, over the course of this summer. And sort of this sense of continuity, this idea of, you know, this being the same roster except freshened up. And there's new hope and it's a different team, but it's the same team and it's the same core. And that's the part of the discussion where I can already see us getting into, like, blame JT Miller and blame Rick Tocchet mode.
Yeah.
Just like this market blamed Travis Green and then blamed Bruce Boudreaux, right? And is going to blame Rick Tocchet. And it's like, guys, all three of those coaches are good. You know, JT Miller, not my favorite guy. I didn't enjoy covering him particularly. I was frequently critical of his defensive play. He's legitimately a star-level player. You know, like this team's... anyway, this team's going to miss him, especially given that he hasn't been replaced at 2LC. So, I don't know. I've been watching the conversation unfold since free agency, and I have this perception or sense that Besser ultimately deciding to stay has kind of propped up an offseason that objectively I think we need to look at as being, you know, pretty questionable in terms of it not being plan A, probably not being plan B, and leaving the Canucks, you know, very much a fringe playoff team in sort of year seven of this Pettersson-Hughes era. And big picture, I just can't help but find that incredibly disappointing.
Yeah, I will say there are multiple things. So when we talk about the core and you know, Adam Foote, you mentioned, speak to Ian McIntyre yesterday for Sportsnet, basically said, hey, it's their room. They've got to hold each other accountable. And essentially, like, this core has to start showing that they can be leaders in the room and, you know, get this team where it needs to be. And the biggest difference, and we'll see if it's going to be a good or bad difference, on the ice, it's obviously a big loss, is JT Miller. Off the ice, I do wonder, and Jamie and I were kind of talking about this yesterday, I do wonder if it at least opens the door for players like Brock Besser or an Elias Pettersson, obviously, to take more of that leadership role. Because we do know, whether you liked it or not, JT Miller was a very vocal person in the locker room and demanded a lot of attention. And I do wonder if that changes the perception within the room and maybe players in the room are able to step up. Now, I don't know how much that's going to reflect on the ice and in the product and how good the Canucks are this year. I do agree with you when it comes to looking at the what they've done over free agency as a whole and having questions, being skeptical about it and feeling like Canucks management, hey, this probably wasn't plan A, B, or C. But that being said, is there room for the vibes to at least be better with the Canucks this season?
Well, there's not room for the vibes to be much worse.
That's true.
You know, and this is the other thing. We're also going to begin to get, you know, whether it was Connor Garland or Tyler Myers, this sort of idea that, like, the noise isn't just behind this team, but was never as bad as the media made it out to be. And the truth is that Canucks management pretty clearly felt that a dramatic change, right, a trade that would make the team worse, had become necessary because of sort of the way that this locker room was interacting. There are people internally that still look at that power play opportunity, the double minor opportunity that the Canucks had against the Edmonton Oilers in Game 7 last spring, and felt that the power play was still running in this way where it was like, these are my touches, these are your touches, as opposed to the group being able to sublimate individual goals for the benefit of the team. And that's a game away from the conference final, right? So, again, the vibes can be better, but who cares? Like, I don't care if a team gets along or doesn't get along, provided that they're able to do the baseline professional stuff that you need to do to win in the NHL and that you need to do to at least make the playoffs consistently, right? I mean, it's not like we're talking about a team that's been falling short in the second round or what have you, right? Like, we're talking about a team that hasn't been able to be a consistent playoff team. And that's 16 out of 32 make it. Average. Be consistently average. And this team hasn't been able to do that. And we're going into another season with very few changes and a new inexperienced head coach who, you know, the club ultimately hired after making Rick Tocchet like a full value offer. He decided not to take it. I'm still processing it. I'm not like out by any means on sort of what's occurred. I think there's a lot of reasons to look at this team's performance last season and expect them to be better. But I'm just sort of watching the vibes-based takes on like various online Canucks-centric conversation centers, whether it's r/Canucks or HF boards or Twitter, X, I guess, is what it's called these days.
You
all the places
Twitter,
that I usually
fine.
Troll. to keep the, like, my finger on the pulse of the most sicko Canucks fans out there. Many of whom listen to our show, by the way, so thank you and hello.
Appreciate it.
But, yeah, we're very grateful. And as I'm just seeing this type of conversation about Tocchet, about Miller, about the vibes, that just reminds me so much of the false hope of the Boudreau era. And I just have zero appetite for that conversation. It's not about what anyone tells us about the vibes or what anyone tells us about the belief in this group or anyone, what anyone says about this team being better than their record last season. And they have a lot of confidence and belief in that room. Do it. Do it and then do it again. Make the season, make the playoffs in consecutive years with this group. Like, do it. Just do it. Find a way to do it. And then we can talk about vibes and how we got there and on and on. But it's very much like the burden of proof has to be on this group to get it done and be an average team 2 years in a row before I'm going to be interested in having that type of conversation.
Yeah, that's fair. And so now the attention turns to, okay, how do you get to that level of being a team that can, you know, make the playoffs consistently? And for the last few years, I feel like there's been a general thought, especially after last season, of like, okay, they've turned the corner and a lot has changed since. But last year at this time, we were kind of talking about, hey, they've turned a corner and now they should be a consistent playoff team at least. And you can look at trying to take those next steps. They fall backwards. A lot goes wrong this season. And you mentioned, you know, like the players are going to kind of, they've been talking and it seems like, hey, they're trying to downplay the noise a little bit. Jim Rutherford even mentioned in an interview with Fan 590 in Toronto that their coaching decision, the head coaching decision, and Adam Foote was kind of informed by what happened in the locker room. Having someone who was familiar with what went down and the noise in the room, not having someone who has to come in and try to figure out the situation, that played a lot into their coaching decision. And so you make these choices, and it has to lead to being a consistent playoff team, making the playoffs consistently, because so far it just hasn't been good enough. And if we're talking about, you know, I think when people talk about Brock Besser coming back and feeling like, you know, that might be a good reflection of the team, I guess, trying to move past the noise, I do have time for it. Like, I do think there is some good reasoning behind, like, hey, things weren't so bad to such a level that everybody involved wanted to leave. But at the same time, you just have to, like, be a better team next season. And I don't know if I look at this roster as it's constructed. And I know you have an article up at The Athletic, Canucks offseason notebook, talking about Pugh Suter's departure and the addition of Evander Kane and kind of if that balances out. I look at this roster and I don't know if I fully believe or I'm convinced yet that it's going to be different next season.
It feels volatile, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's where the Canucks have been for the last, like, 7 years, is in a volatile state.
Yeah, and, you know, the defense is much improved in that you probably do have three defenders that I rate as top pair caliber guys. Now, three defenders that I rate as top pair caliber guys, one of them is not like the others, right? One of them is the most impactful two-way defenseman in hockey. And the other two are, you know, guys that are at the very worst or at the low end, like 2/3s. But I like them both better than that in Hronek and Marcus Pettersson. And that's a level of talent on the back end that this organization hasn't iced since, I don't know, Bieksa, Hamhuis, Edler, Tanev. I mean, you probably have to go back 15 years to find a defense as deep as that at the top end. Forbert, dependable. Tyler Myers played really well last year. If he can sustain that, he's a credible top four guy. Let's say a 4x5 or a 4/5. And then you've got outs, right? If Mancini, Volander, Elias Pettersson are able to be those sorts of young defensemen that come in and make a real impact right away, right? If Volander can follow that Brock Faber path, right? If Elias Pettersson can basically just start up where he left off, because he looked like, to me anyway, a guy who 50 games into next year could be having a top four impact, and we wouldn't be shocked, like that Dylan Sandberg type trajectory. You know, if some of those outs hit, this could be an elite defense core.
I think it's not necessarily going to be,
but it could be.
I was going to say, I feel like this is maybe the most excited people have been about a defense core in Vancouver in a very long time. For justifiable reasons, right? Like you mentioned Quinn Hughes, obviously, one of the top two defensemen in the NHL. And then you have two top pairing defensemen in Filip Ronek, Marcus Pettersson. And then the upside of these guys that you mentioned, Elias Pettersson, Tom Melander, like this feels like the most intriguing and exciting defense unit we've seen from the Canucks in a very, very long time.
Yeah, no question about it. There is some fragility there, right? It's not for sure going to be the best defense core we've seen in 15 years because there are still a lot of young players involved. You know, Tyler Myers played extraordinarily well last season. Quinn Hughes is probably still going to be, like this club's probably still going to be a little bit too dependent on Hughes from the perspective of generating offense and driving play. And we saw last year, you know, he got hurt in that Dallas Stars game. And his form the last 30-plus games was not quite at the this guy should be on every heart ballot form of the first 50, right? This might be the best 50-game stretch I've ever seen from a Canucks player, right? Because that's the level that Hughes was at. And, you know, once he had that oblique injury and it spiraled and he had some compensation injuries trying to rush back, you know, there were still moments like that New York Rangers game that they lost, but he completely dominated, right? Like there were still moments where you could see it, but it wasn't an every night, oh my God, the Canucks have a player who looks like he's Connor McDavid out there, except he's playing on the back end, which he did in the first 50 games. So, I mean, you still need health. You still need these young guys to punch above their weight. But the range of outcomes on Vancouver's defense core is high end. And the downside's not that minimal, because at the very least, I think we feel very comfortable about what Hughes, Marcus Pettersson, and Hronek are as players. In goal, though, you obviously have a fair bit of volatility. Lankinen was incredible, but he's been a 1B guy throughout his career. Can he repeat what he did last season is certainly a fair question. And then, you know, Thatcher Demko is the wild card of wild cards, right? Could he be the best NHL goaltender across a 40-game stretch or a 50-game stretch? Like, maybe. Absolutely has the talent to do it. But it wasn't just that he was out of the lineup for three different extended injury-related absences last season. He also wasn't performing, you know, in rhythm the way that he has in the past. He wasn't dominant. He had some flashes of the old Demko, like that week before the Four Nations tournament, but it wasn't sustained excellence from Demko, generally speaking, in his starts. Like, is there going to be an injury impact from that popliteus tear? Like, does he get back to being the 9-10 goaltender with stretches of dominance that we've seen? You know, I think that's an open question. And so we expect the Canucks to have strong goaltending. They expect themselves to have strong goaltending, clearly. But, you know, there's a range of outcomes where this team is, you know, 15th, 16th, 17th, maybe lower. There's a downside case, too, and a high-end case for what sort of goaltending this team will receive. And then you get to the center ice position. And this is where I wrote about it at The Athletic today, about Pugh Suter's departure, right? Because, you know, I think Pugh Suter's a good player. Everyone knows how high I've been on him since before he signed in Vancouver. And his departure, where I think it's really going to be felt, is that it removes just a floor case from this Canucks center group. And that center group is where, man, I really do think this season is going to be determined, at least to this point. Canucks management will keep working. They'll keep looking to see if they can find an answer or an upgrade or another lottery ticket even, like another good dart throw to give them top nine production. But Pettersson, we really have no idea what we're going to get. He could show up at camp and be one of the best players in the world. He could show up at camp and be like a 60-point defensively oriented center that doesn't have juice. And neither outcome would surprise me, mm-hmm. right? Filip Hedl could totally be a 50-point middle six impact center who's not driving a line necessarily, but is perfectly effective. He could also play 20 games, right? Like, we have no idea. And then Atu Ratu and Max Sasson, completely untested. In Ratu's case, he's also dealing with an injury that he sustained in the playoffs late in the year. How does that impact his summer training, especially given that he's a guy who still needs to add a step if he's going to be a full-time NHL-level center? He's definitely going to get a shot, but I think there's a ton of uncertainty and a ton of volatility with both of those gentlemen. And then Teddy Bluger, you know, we've seen Bluger fill in the top nine for stretches, provided he's with Connor Garland, it can work, but... You know, you certainly don't want him playing 15 to 18 minutes a night if you're going to score. Like, if you're going to manufacture offense, that's a tough spot to be in. So, to me anyway, there's no question that if this is going to work, the centers need to hit. At least a couple of those guys need to hit at the high-end range of their outcomes. And realistically, the Canucks can't afford to have the bear case hit on any of them. Right, right. Like, none of them can hit sort of the lower end range of the realistic, the bell curve, as it were. Because if they do, I think this team's really going to struggle to score and control play and win games.
Especially the top two ones. Like, I think there maybe is a world where you get by with Teddy Bluger, you know, having a... Like, you kind of know what you're going to get from Bluger consistently, right? To a relative level. But the top two guys, Elias Pettersson and Filip Hedl, if one or both of them don't hit, you're in a really, really tough spot. And Elias Pettersson, I mean, we talk about it almost every day. It all comes back to Elias Pettersson. So much of next season hinges on what he is and if he can return to form, if he can be that guy. I don't even think he needs to be a 100-point guy, you know, but if you can be around a point per game and contributing at an elite level defensively, like we've seen from Elias Pettersson, that would be what the Canucks need next season. And Filip Hedl, I don't know what to expect fully. Like, he was exciting when he was healthy, but the question of when he's healthy and how long he's going to be healthy is always going to be the biggest conversation with Filip Hedl. So it does, and we can get into this because we're kind of tight for time on the other side of the break, but the question comes up of like, okay, do the Canucks need just at least one more guy who, if one of these middle six players don't work out, or Filip Hedl gets injured, or you need help because Atu Ratu isn't ready, do they have another lottery ticket they can throw in there? And there are some options. We'll get into that on the other side, though. It is Canucks talk. Josh Elliott-Wolf, Thomas Drantz. I also wanted to talk about a bet that Lena finally cashed in on. So we'll do that later. It is Canucks talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott-Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you. Coming to you live from the Kintex studio. You can text in 650-650. The Dunbar Lumber text line, by the way, at 1 o'clock. Harmon Dial of The Athletic is going to join us and guests on Sportsnet 650. They call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. And I did also want to mention, we're the home stretch of the Sportsnet 650 Jays Care 50-50. You can win half the jackpot. The other half supports Challenger Baseball, a program that helps kids of all abilities across BC thrive through sport. Tickets start at just $10. You can get bundles for even more chances to win. Go to jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com. July 7th is the final day to enter. And then July 8th on Halford and Brough, they will announce the winner. So get your tickets once again at jayscaregolf.rafflenexus.com. Coming back from break there, we were playing some music. Lena got in my ear and she was like, this is giving Minecraft vibes. And that's a really good segue, Lena, because, Drantz, I'm not sure if you were aware, but we had a bet on Canucks Brunch where it was a best of three of playoff series. So it was the Stars Colorado, it was the Battle of Ontario, and the Battle of Florida. And Lena and I, we each picked a team from each series. I ended up winning. I picked two of them correct, the Leafs and the Panthers. Or was it the Leafs and the Panthers? Leafs, yes. And Stars.
No, Leafs and Ottawa were playing.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sorry, I got the Leafs correct.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. Regardless, the bet was, the payment was, whoever lost had to watch the Minecraft movie twice.
In theaters alone.
Yes. Since then, we brought it down to just one. So Lena, you finally watched the Minecraft movie. How was it?
I'm going to completely rethink my life after this, because my standards and expectations were so insanely low for this movie. This is a movie I obviously did not want to watch, okay?
It was a punishment.
I never played Minecraft, and everyone told me, yeah, it's so bad, it's almost good. And if you played, Zach next to me said, hey, if you liked playing Minecraft, this movie will be fun for you. And I said, well, I didn't play Minecraft. Anyways, I watched it. I actually thoroughly enjoyed it.
Wow.
I didn't know Jennifer Coolidge made an appearance in the movie, and Jason Momoa was really entertaining throughout the entire movie, and honestly, they let Jack Black be Jack Black in the entirety of the movie, and that's where he thrives. So
like 10 out of 10?
No, okay. So if I actually thought about this last night. If I were to rate the movie out of 10, I'd give it a 4.2.
4.2.
Very really specific.
Very specific.
Yeah.
I guess it's not bad. That's
some
like
jokes
fine.
Landed.
Yeah.
And I actually laughed out loud.
Whoa.
I know.
Good
shocking.
For you.
But yeah, I enjoyed it. Drans, have you watched Minecraft?
No.
I don't suggest you watch it.
I'll probably watch it with my nephew at some point.
Yeah, you don't have to.
I know he hasn't seen it, so
all right.
That feels like set up the outdoor projector, you know, on a summer night.
Yeah, good vibe.
Good to watch. That feels like something like that, and then I'll spend most of the movie on my phone.
Good call.
But he'll be excited.
Yeah. 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep the text coming in there. Before the break, we did mention as well, we were talking about the center position and how much hinges on the center position for the Vancouver Canucks, and we did mention as well, he had an article up at The Athletic, an off-season notebook for the Vancouver Canucks, and one of the sections was Midsummer Value Watch, and that's where the Canucks got Pew Suter a couple of years ago. They've found players, they've taken bets in the past couple of off-seasons.
Whether they've hit or not.
Midsummer. Yeah, exactly. And so you outlined some players who could be bettable midsummer here. Is there anyone who was your ideal target of those mentioned?
No.
Okay, great. Never mind.
No, the truth is that this is a very weak free agent class, and as a result of the cap growth era working its way through the system, the usual like secondary market bets haven't really come up. It's been really, really difficult in terms of teams finding value. There were a few bets that I thought were interesting. Pontus Holmberg, who signed with the Tampa Bay Lightning, was a player that, you know, I thought was potentially fascinating, potentially worth a gamble. But he's really more of a fourth line center given his offensive toolkit. Really good defensive depth center, though. I mean, I like him a lot, but more in the Teddy Bluger mold in terms of some of the offensive limitations. You know, Jacob Pelletier, Matai Blumel, most of those guys have already signed because everyone had to work so much harder to find those bettable profiles. Now, Jack Roslovic is a player that the Canucks didn't think they'd be able to afford effectively. Like, they thought he was going to demand a price point that would exceed their appetite going into July 1. Like, this is prior to the market opening. The fact that he remains unsigned, however, 4 days into free agency, you know, it's not enough time to pass, but two more weeks go by and the price might start to drop, right? This is how this works. And that's when the Canucks like to pounce on a Daniel Sprong or a Pew Suter. Obviously, those two examples had wildly disparate outcomes in terms of their impact on this roster, but it's the same fundamental bet. And both were worthwhile, even if one worked out 99th percentile and the other worked out 1 percentile. I didn't work out at all. Mm-hmm. So if the price drops enough on Roslovic, he'd certainly be a standout. The other guy that I wonder about is Robbie Fabbri. Now, I think Fabry's more of a winger at this stage. He's had a lot of lower body injuries, and it's sort of zapped some of the pace that he was able to play with as a younger player. But this is a guy who can just absolutely rip the puck. I mean, he's still a high-end shooter in NHL terms, with power play utility and a variety of other skills as a result. Much like Roslovic, he's more center-capable than he is a full-time center. But he'd be sort of an interesting bounce-back name that I'd, certainly be interested in seeing. And then there's a couple ex-Carolina Hurricanes. So these are players drafted by Jim Rutherford. So there's a personal relationship there. In the case of one of them, Rutherford also repatriated him to Pittsburgh once upon a time. But Brock McGinn and Jeff Skinner are a couple guys that I think are mildly interesting as, sort of one-year vet minimum bets. Skinner's not really a center at this point, but despite struggling to get into the Oilers lineup, I thought there was a lot of good stuff that he put on tape in terms of working the puck into high-danger areas and generating scoring chances, even against that, Big Red Panthers machine in the Stanley Cup Final. And then McGinn, it sucks because he actually is, in my view anyway, like a third liner who has some of that heavy skill that teams fall over themselves to get. And he's a guy who can actually play center, but he tore his ACL in January. Mm-hmm. And we saw with Ilya Mikheyev, right? I almost feel like if you're signing McGinn, you want to do like a two-year vet minimum type contract, because realistically, I don't think you're going to get him at 100% full tilt next year. It's almost like you want to get him in. Maybe he goes to the American League, becomes familiar. Maybe he's a fourth liner, whatever. But the season after, I actually think he could be a screaming value. So he'd be a name to track. Here's another one for you, by the way, Josh. The Canucks have Jet Wu and Nikita Tolopilo still unsigned as RFAs.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those gentlemen are arbitration eligible. Now, it's either today or tomorrow is the deadline for player-elected salary arbitration. And the day after that, so either tomorrow or the day after, is the deadline for team-elected salary arbitration. Why does this matter? If you have an arbitration case that gets settled, you open up a second buyout window upon that deal settling, which lives for a week. Now, the Canucks don't have any contracts that they'd look to buy out, but the Dallas Stars do. And they're not the only one. There's a few teams around the league who didn't exercise buyouts in the first buyout window, but still have some guys that would make sense for them to either buy out or to shed. And potentially a team could take on that contract and be willing to buy it out and be incentivized to do so. And I just sort of wonder, is there a world where the Canucks let Jet Wu schedule an arbitration hearing, right? Once the NHLPA has that scheduled, you settle right beforehand, you open that second buyout window. Not that Dallas and the Vancouver Canucks have a long history of cooperating, but mm-hmm. is there a world where you could then go and offer, hey, so we shed Dakota Joshua for a fourth round pick, right? So you Dakota Joshua to Chicago, because Chicago always takes on Vancouver's cap dump players.
They're always there for the Canucks.
So Dakota Joshua to Chicago for a third round pick, okay? And then you take that third round pick, add a second to it, and you go to Dallas to try and get Maverick Bourque, but you take on Matt Dumba's contract and buy it out.
Hmm. I mean, that would
just a weird angle, but like that exists as an option for the Canucks, provided that either they elect to take Tolopilo or Wu to arbitration, or one of those players opts for arbitration in the next 24 hours.
I mean, if you shed Dakota Joshua, do you have to buy out Matt Dumba, or would you just like keep him on the roster as an option? Not that you'd be like super intrigued by it, and not that the Canucks need another defenseman in the mix, but I kind of wonder if they'd be more willing to do that than than buy out Matt Dumba.
You've filled my head with a devious plan, which would be 25 games of Matt Dumba stapled to Quinn Hughes.
Woo.
Could you rebuild him into an asset?
Yeah. Flip him at the deadline for a third? Why not? I'm open to it.
I don't think so. I think it's too cute. But and the contract's like very buyoutable, right? It would only cost you like $1.6 million the first year and like $800K the next year, right? It's not cumbersome at all. The way to think of it is you'd be adding Maverick Bork for $2.5 million. And boom, you have another out, right? Like another player that, you know, if the bull case hits on him, all of a sudden your biggest weakness might be, you know, much closer to league average, because Bork, a 23-year-old right-handed center who I've really been impressed with when I've seen him live, you know, all of a sudden that's a player who, you know, maybe can give you third-line value next season. And boy, reliable third line value from the center ice position for this Canucks team, that could mean an awful lot in terms of getting you, you know, at least into the mix of being able to hang with the Utahs and the St. Louis's and the LA Kings of the world.
Yeah, and to me, like, that would be, that's a much more intriguing option than like all the lists of like, hey, best remaining free agents are coming out from all the publications, and it's like, ah, these guys are all bad, aside from, you know, a few guys or Jack Roslovic, who, you know, I'd be interested in, especially if the price continues to come down. But I also just kind of wonder if Carolina, with all their cap space, are like, well, we'll figure out a way to bring him back because they need centers too. Maverick Bork, I've long been a fan of as well. I'd be very, very interested in seeing what it costs, especially because he only signed that 1 year deal in Dallas. My fear was that they might figure out a way to kind of lock him up longer term at a team friendly price. But I'd be interested in him. And that this is kind of the thing with the Canucks. It's like, you've got to find situations where around the league that you can try to maybe take advantage of and make another bet. Like, you're not going to find a player that is a clear cut top six forward, top six option, especially at center this offseason. Right? Like, it's just not going to happen, especially not until teams start to get into the regular season and maybe get hit with the realization that they're not going to be a playoff team. For now, it feels like every team in the NHL thinks they're going to be a playoff team. And if you can find situations, maybe like a Bork, or if there are other ones around the NHL where you can take on a guy, maybe give a team some help, and get an asset back that can actually play for you with that would be a much more interesting option to me than hoping someone shakes loose in free agency here.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the trade market is and has always been the most likely route for the Canucks to find a second line center upgrade. They're definitely going to keep working at it. I mean, there's no question about it. And, you know, it might not be something you accomplish in late summer. We might see some activity here, but we also might see, you know, this Canucks team needs to get just enough out of Pettersson, Hedl, Ratu to leg it out and stay in the mix and get off to a good start and get to November 15th through December 1st, at which point usually, you know, if past behavior is any indication, there's going to be 10 NHL general managers that wake up on American Thanksgiving and think to themselves, oh boy, I've got to make a change. This isn't going
to
work.
That's kind of always been the most realistic option too. Like I said it, I think on free agency day, it's like, okay, bringing it back to, you know, the Canucks running it back and this not being their A plan. It does feel like the Canucks are kind of saving their bullets for when better options could be available if they're in a position to make those trades at whatever point in the season those options become available, because it kind of feels like the strategy from management right now, and they've had to pivot to it, has been, okay, run it back with the same team, hope the defense and hope the goaltending can do enough to win enough games, you know, 3-1, 3-2, 2-1, until you get to a point where other teams are out of the playoff race and are willing to move a top six center. And if you're in a playoff position or in and around a playoff spot, maybe you're more willing to move your 2026 first round pick, lottery protected, however, whatever protection you want to put on it, and see how much value that holds around the league.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to think of it. By the way, the mentions or the inbox saying Canucks have never taken a bad contract to get an asset, .. enough from Curtis and Tatown. This organization has never thought creatively, says Tim. It's never going to happen. So, fair enough.
First time you for know, everything, though. You got to believe. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
You got to believe. I don't know. I mean, you know what? These fans might have a point. This is just the... This is my version of getting excited about the new vibes.
Yeah, good call.
You know, where it's just like I'm banging my head against a wall, much like fans are just like, this is the year where this group takes accountability and gets it all together under a new coach. A new coach will fix it all.
We do for the fourth time. I haven't heard that before. Years. Yeah, we do get a few texts as well because so far through the offseason, when we've talked about the Canucks needing to shed salary, especially if they are going to find a way to bring in another center, it kind of came up with Pugh Suter. And hey, if they find a way to bring him back, they're going to have to move salary. Obviously, that didn't happen. But if they take on essentially any contract, they're going to have to move salary away from the wings. And we get a few texts being like, why is Dakota Joshua the name that keeps coming up for the Vancouver Canucks? And one question saying, why have they changed their tune on Dakota Joshua? Why do you think, Drance, Joshua is the name that comes up for the Canucks when we talk about shedding salary from the wings?
Well, there's 3 million reasons. Mm-hmm. His cap hit is sufficient for you to have real flexibility if you move off of that commitment. Plus, the team brought in Drew O'Connor at the trade deadline, big forward, and Evander Kane just before July 1, another big forward. So, you know, I think there's certainly a story that they could tell themselves about Joshua being surplus to requirement, given sort of their position. And if you're going to make an ad, like Teddy Bluger at 1.8 doesn't really move the needle. Nils Höglander would, given that he's coming into his $3 million per year extension. But Nils Höglander also kind of quietly had a breakout after, you know, in the second half of the year anyway, after he put that one bad back check against the Carolina Hurricanes behind him and started playing higher up the lineup again, he was, you know, one of Vancouver's most productive forwards. So, you know, I think that's it. Like, I haven't heard, I heard Rick Dhaliwal suggest that the club had soured on Dakota Joshua specifically, and that's a direct, like, term that Dhaliwal had used. I haven't heard that. But I do think there's openness to moving him or Bluger. I also heard Dhaliwal say that Höglander is another name to keep in mind on the morning show. That's not a name that I've heard. Bluger and Joshua have been sort of the guys that I've been most focused on in terms of if the club needs cap space, who could move. Those are the guys that I'm focused on.
Yeah, the Höglander one to me, especially in a season where you're gonna need offense, right? You're gonna have to find ways to get offense out of this lineup. Höglander, to me, I know some people are maybe higher on him than others, but even if you're not super high on him, I think there's still enough offense there to be intrigued by, and it would be a more of a risky move, I think, than someone like Dakota Joshua. But that being said, it does kind of feel like the Canucks are going in on this philosophy of being a very difficult team to play against. And Höglander has that element to him, but I think Dakota Joshua also has a lot of that element to him as well, being a bigger body.
Yeah, I believe
in
Dakota Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
To be clear, like, I don't think he's like just a fourth liner that they, you know, placed a bad bet on. I think he's, you know, not a guy who's going to drive play, but he's really well calibrated to play with Connor Garland. On a middle six line that can absolutely win its minutes And I think he's got really good hands in tight. People will say, oh, they paid for a shooting percentage bender that he went on in the 2023-24 season. And it's like, yeah, maybe. Maybe there was a little bit of good fortune there. But also, he scored a ton of goals with expert finishes lifting the puck in traffic from 3-4 feet out. Right? Like, we've seen that type of goal scorer, Milan Lucic, famously, sustain elevated shooting percentages over large samples. Because if you're a big guy with good hands and tight, and you're able to play with a guy who can get you the puck in those spots, you know, you're likely to shoot a higher percentage than like a defenseman ripping it from the point or a perimeter oriented forward. You know, I'm a Joshua believer. I like his penalty killing. I like his work as an F1. He can take some draws, too. I mean, honestly, I think this club might even want to consider sort of seeing what he can do at center.
I was going to bring this
in
up.
In a pinch.
Like an intriguing option that, you know, it might work. It might definitely not work. But maybe give it a shot, Dakota Joshua, trying him at center and seeing if there's something there.
Yeah, I don't love it because I like him more as an F1 than as an F3. Like, I like him more as the first guy in on the forecheck because I think he's really good at chasing down defenders and using his size to be disruptive, sort of cutting off the opposition's breakout or attack right at the stem. But, you know, so I think it's a break glass in case of emergency option, but certainly he could help out on draws if you end up with, like, Max Sasson playing top nine center. Less of a concern for Ratu, but, you know, if it's Hedl with Joshua and Garland, I think he can help out. So, yeah, I'm a believer in Joshua as a bounce-back candidate more than I am sort of subscribing to the idea that he's a player that the club should, you know, be paying anything to get off of, which I don't think they'd have to, by the way. I don't think he would be a cap dump of that magnitude in the marketplace.
It is Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here on Sportsnet 650. On the other side, we're going to talk to Herman Dial from The Athletic. It is Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz here with you, coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. You can text in 650-650, the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and Breno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. Harmon Dial of The Athletic is going to join us shortly as we begin the final hour of Canucks Talk for the season on Sportsnet 650. How you feeling, Drantz? One more hour and then you're out of here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I'm going to miss it. I love doing this show.
It's a good show. It's a fun show.
Yeah, it's fun. Every day, come on and, you know, complain for 2 hours and have people get mad at me. It's like, yeah, that's all I want.
that's the Thomas Drantz dream. We go to the hotline now, powered by Power West Industries. It is Harmon Dial of The Athletic joining us. Appreciate you taking the time, Harm. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Doing really, really well. And we've had a few days to sit and reflect and absorb what the Canucks did and did not do in free agency. With these few days to look back on it, how do you feel about where the Canucks are at right now?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's layered, right? Because I think a couple of things can be true at the same time, where number one, when the season ended, hearing Jim Rutherford talk about how he wanted to fundamentally transform the forward group and the top six attack, when you look at that sort of ambition that they had, clearly they weren't able to accomplish that exactly, right? We can debate, you know, with Evander Kane coming in, Pia Suter out, you can debate what player you prefer. They're obviously very different stylistically, but I think in terms of overall impact, whether you lean Kane, whether you lean Suter, they're both good players, and it's kind of a wash. And then bringing Besser back, they weren't able to really meaningfully upgrade the 6-4 group, which is underwhelming initially. But I also think context matters. And when I look at the market dynamics and how difficult it was to find true top lineup difference makers, I mean, by my count, there were only three first-line caliber forwards that switched teams this year, this offseason, and Paterka, Marner, and Ehlers. And so that context matters. And I think anytime you head into an offseason and you've got this sort of win-now ambition to get better, the first priority in my mind is always make sure you don't step on a landmine. Don't sign an outrageous contract that you're going to regret as soon as you sign it. Don't overpay for a mediocre center on the trade market and mortgage. Pick some prospects for a player that isn't worth the cost. And I think they've at least shown some restraint on that front, and they've avoided that would have been my worry, right? Is, all right, the market's tough. Are they going to get desperate and start stepping on landmines? And they sort of avoided that. And so when I step back and look at it, especially the re-signing Besser component, I like that idea a lot. The overall improvement on paper in terms of the forward group is underwhelming, but all things considered, I'm at least appreciative that they didn't do anything reckless and desperate.
Do you think, Dom Lecision's model would definitely look askance at the Besser extension, and the Demko extension too seems to have a fair bit of possible downside. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully, Demko returns to full health and his usual level of performance. But there are certainly a couple of bets that, you're right. There's no Chandler Stephenson level recklessness there, but some bets that, are going to have a difficult time being efficient as they age, even with the cap growth era sort of upon us.
Yeah, that's fair. I think Demko especially, that was the one that I sort of raised my eyebrows at. An $8.5 million cap hit, that's really steep. So yeah, that's the one, I think, contract that I'd quibble with a little bit. The Besser one, I don't mind. I understand the sort of downside risk, and I do wonder about, will the Canucks be able to unlock the best version of him at 5-on-5 now that JT Miller is no longer on the team? And a lot of that, I think, predicates on Elias Pettersson bouncing back, because if he doesn't, then Besser, yeah, we know he can score goals at even strength, but he's more been a power play guy in terms of that production level. And at 5-on-5, we saw at post-Miller trade, it was tough for him to find chemistry with Pettersson and Hedl. But in having said that, I think relative to the other options that were available, that was the best one in terms of you've got $7.25 million in cap space. You need a top six solution, whether it be a winger or a center. I think that was the best option that they had. There's some risk on that, but also we know how important it is for the team to be competitive this coming season. I just don't think there was a better alternative when it came to Besser.
When it comes to...
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. Oh, now we're both going ahead. Okay, I'll go. So when it comes to the way the contracts are situated now, your top two highest paid forwards, Elias Pettersson and Brock Besser, we haven't necessarily seen them have chemistry since the Lotto line time, and obviously that had JT Miller on the line as well. I think there were spurts throughout this past season with the Nils Höglander, Elias Pettersson, Brock Besser line that looked decent when it was together, and then Höglander and Pettersson had their own injury issues. Do you think they need to give Besser and Pettersson some run together this upcoming season?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I think the fit with Hedl was, you could tell just the disparity with a foot speed and how Hedl likes to attack off the rush. I'm not sure that's Brock's bread and butter exactly. And especially I like the idea of trying Höglander, Pettersson, Besser, right? I've seen some people mocking lines of like Kane, Pettersson, and Besser. My worry is that's enough speed on the wings. You got two guys that are more complementary, sort of, they're great goal scorers, but they're kind of passengers. And I wonder if that puts too much of a play driving sort of burden on Pettersson, whereas Höglander and Pettersson, especially in the second half, have shown chemistry together. Höglander with the speed, ability to win puck battles, I think can sort of help that line, spend more time in the offensive zone, give them a element, and so it matters, right? I don't want to be, you know, for example, if you have both Kane and Besser on the line with Pettersson, I just don't know if you're going to have enough pace, especially because when we saw, let's say, DeBrusk, Pettersson, and Besser at times, like that line looked a little bit slow at times. And obviously Kane is a little bit slower than DeBrusk too. So, yeah, I mean, I think they have to give Pettersson and Besser run. They have to give them some rope, and I'd like to see Höglander be the third forward that that joins them.
When it comes to finding the ideal fit for Filipino, it does feel like, hey, the Canucks very likely are going to go into next season with Philip Hedel as their 2C. Who's the ideal fit on the wings with Hedel?
Yeah, one idea that I liked was Hedel, Garland, and Evander Kane. With the idea sort of being you have Hedel with his ability to drive zone entries, transport pucks up the ice. Garland is such a spark plug, winning goals, and he drives play a lot. And I think that puts Evander Kane in a position to succeed where he doesn't have to do a lot of the heavy lifting play driving, and especially playing with Connor Garland, who's a terrific playmaker down low. For Evander Kane at that point, it's just finding ways to get open, finish chances, and even Kane's shot off the rush. He can beat goalies from distance clean, and for Hedel, I think that could be great because he drove a lot of controlled entries in the brief time that we saw him as a Canuck, but the issue was, all right, how do you translate this into actual goals? Like, there are chances, but the actual finish was maybe lacking on that line, and that's where I think Evander Kane could provide some value. So that's a line that I'd like to see them potentially experiment with in training camp.
Would you go Pettersson with Hughes as part of a five-man unit, whatever else it looks like, whether it's, you know, Hronek, DeBrusk, Höglander, Besser, you know, choose your own adventure, but just Hughes being played with Pettersson so that you amp up sort of the skill level and the goal differential that you're able to generate in those Quinn Hughes minutes? Or would you rather see him used to prop up the non-Hughes minutes and give you an opportunity to manufacture at least some goals, some offensive threat in those non-Hughes minutes, which have been so problematic for the Canucks, even dating back to that successful 2023-24 campaign?
Yeah, I would lean toward wanting Hughes and Pettersson a little bit separately. Of course, in situations when you're trailing in a game, like that's the beauty of it, is you can be fluid, and in the third period, you're down a goal or two, you can stack those guys together as a five-man unit. But I think this team was so anemic at generating offense in non-Hughes minutes that you're hoping that Pettersson can bounce back and be a driver on his own. And my worry would be, if you have a scenario where, let's say, Pettersson does return to form, is a point-per-game guy, that if you stack him with Hughes, yeah, great, you're going to have a terrific sort of fastball, but are you going to have enough when those guys are on the bench? And I think, you know, separating them a little bit does give you the opportunity to, you know, maximize the number of minutes where you have one of Hughes or Pettersson on the ice. So that's the way that that I would lean, but it also kind of depends on how these guys look when the season starts, right? We still don't know exactly what version of Pettersson we're going to get. We don't know what version of Hedel we're going to get. And I don't say that as a negative. I mean that in the sense of like he could stay healthy. And if he's paired with the right line mates, there's the potential for him to modestly break out and play at a legit sort of second line level. And all of a sudden, if you then have a scenario where, let's say, a Hedel line can actually hold its own away from Hughes, and the Pettersson line is the one that maybe needs more of a spark, then that conversation could shift, and we could look at it as, all right, the Pettersson, like, you need more juice at the top of the lineup. All right, that means you have to give Pettersson and Hughes more shifts together. So my initial preference would be to keep Pettersson and Hughes a little bit more separated, but it depends on how Pedersen and Hedl actually fare when the season starts, I think, in terms of how capable are they at driving their own line.
And with what remains in unrestricted free agency, is there any names that interest you should their value plummet a bit as they fall through the cracks?
Yeah, if Roslovic's value plummets, he'd be intriguing, right? Can play center, can play wing, speedy, dynamic. He's prone to inconsistency, and he can be a frustrating player at times, but this is also a guy that scored 22 goals, and for as much as we talk about his defensive flaws, it is at least a promising sign that he had some level of success in Carolina, where they obviously have a very particular way that they want to play under Rod Brind'Amour. So he'd be a name to keep an eye on. Outside of that, there aren't too many guys that sort of stand out to me as really warranting a long look.
We kind of mentioned it earlier, but the Canucks not making any trades so far throughout the offseason, no trades to address the center position, obviously making the Evander Kane trade, but it did kind of feel like they have one or two shots to take in a trade to address the center position. And when we looked at the options and the amount of teams that would be in it, it kind of felt like it was going to be an uphill battle for the Canucks. It obviously was. What do you think of going into next season and kind of seeing where you're at and seeing which teams fall out of the picture, and then, taking that one shot, whether it be in November, December, to address the center position? Can they afford to wait that long, I guess, is what I'm asking.
I don't mind the wait and see approach, just because, again, what's the alternative, right? I don't see a lot of, forget top six centers, even if you're talking third line center caliber, I just don't see a lot of names available, and even if they were available, because of how many teams are looking for help down the middle, I don't know if the acquisition cost would be worth it. And I also think, to a certain extent, it gives you an opportunity to see how the team fares in the first couple months of the season and evaluate if this team is worth continually investing in, right? Because this manager group by extending Besser, extending Demko, extending Garland, they've doubled down on this core. So I don't mind the idea of seeing, like, let's see how the season goes. Is this group worth continually, like, I want to see on-ice success. And then you feel a lot more comfortable potentially giving up future assets, as opposed to surrendering those assets for, potentially mediocre player. And then what if we come into training camp and the season starts and the team sort of falls a little bit flat, and now you sort of regret having given up some of your premium assets. Now, I will say, while the supply crunch will probably ease a little bit by the time some teams start to fall out, I'm not sure that it's going to, like, I still expect it to be competitive and not so easy to find your sort of dream center, because I think a lot of teams are in a similar boat where they probably didn't get all their shopping done this summer, and they're going to be looking at in-season upgrades. I think there are going to be a lot of teams in a similar boat, and I'm not sure how many teams are going to fall out of it quickly enough to really quickly shift into seller mode. By the time you get into November, December, you're not guaranteed that those opportunities are going to open up. But again, I'd rather them wait it out than do something reckless or desperate. And it may not be the worst thing to just see, is this group one that you can have success with before you continue to invest even more assets into supporting this group.
The other part of that too, if there are multiple teams in on whatever players become available as the season goes on, how likely are the Canucks to be a team that has the most desirable assets around the league for whatever top six center becomes available?
Well, it depends on what they're willing to give up, right? The Canucks have, it's not that the Canucks don't have assets, it's what are they willing to part ways with, right? Because, Drancer's obviously done some reporting on this front, but when it comes to DPD, for example, like, he's been an untouchable. Willander, they're probably highly reluctant to move him. You know, same thing with Becker Mackey, and now you've got another high quality prospect that you added to the system in Coots. You're going to have your 2026 first round pick, which now I would not trade. But if you get to, let's say, January, and you know for sure that you're going to make the playoffs, then at that point, that's a pick that you're probably more comfortable dealing away with. So, to me, it isn't so much this team doesn't have assets. It's what are they actually going to be willing to surrender for that top six center? And I think that I would imagine they'll be a lot more comfortable potentially dangling, one of their better prospects, and let's say that 2026 first round pick, in a package for top six center in January, if you can look at this team sort of like you did 2 years ago and realize that, oh yeah, this team's definitely going to make the playoffs and they're worth investing in. Whereas, you know, doing that right now is a lot more dicey, is a lot more risky. So I think if this team proves that they're good enough, they'll have the assets to go in on this group if they want to.
Harmon, let's do a game to end your final Canucks Talk hit of the year. We've loved having you, by the way, and thank you for your time. You were a killer deadline acquisition for us at midseason. Okay, so I'm going to shoot scenarios at you involving Canucks centermen and their probable range of outcomes, and I want you to give a percentage chance, a confidence interval, and explain why for each scenario. You ready?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so Elias Pettersson returns and is a 90-plus point play driver again the way he used to be, with visible juice on a near every shift basis.
I'd say 30 to 40. And the reason I say that is I expect him to be better than he was this past season. But 90 plus points and sort of being this game breaker again, that's a lofty bar. You're asking for the best version of Pettersson. He's only hit 90 points once in his career, right? I know the 2023-24 was, he hit 89. So it was really close, but that was obviously also a season where the entire second half, essentially, the All-Star break onward, he was a shell of his former self. So really, for Pettersson to be 90 plus points, consistent play driver for a whole season, he's only really done that one season in his career so far. So I'd actually lean more towards the like 30% range, and obviously those probabilities would increase if it was, if you had set the bar at, let's say, like 75 to 80 points. But yeah, 90 plus points, I lean towards like the 30-ish% range.
And let's do the opposite. Pettersson comes back and is a 60-point, you know, 5-on-5 neutral player with more defensive impact than offensive impact the way we saw this season.
So you're saying basically we get the same version of him?
Yep.
I'd also peg that at around 30%. My sort of overall sort of guess is that he'll bounce back, but not exactly be, you know, the absolute like 90 to 100 point version of himself. put it this way, I don't think he's going to be as bad as he was this past season, but I also am not entirely convinced that he's going to be the absolute apex version of himself. I wouldn't be surprised if we get a version of him that's in the middle, where, I don't know, maybe he's somewhere in the 70 to 80 point range, and we, like, in terms of the play driving element, it's a little bit on and off, where for some stretches of the season, he does look like that dynamic, single-handedly driving a line player. But, you know, you also sort of potentially get some lulls. I think over Pettersson's career, we've seen that he's kind of an inconsistent player when it comes to that top gear that he has. And so I think this past season was probably the worst that we'll see him. And again, I do expect him to bounce back, but that's sort of my overall expectation for him. Is that he'll be somewhere in between where he was last season and the like most dominant 95 to 100 point version of himself.
Filip Hedl, by the way, You know, I'm not going to ask you to factor in injuries. So we're just factoring in performance, not games played. Okay? Filip Hedl is a, like, capitalizes off some of that neutral zone play driving and hits 50 points.
Yeah, I mean, if you know that he's going to be healthy, I would put greater than 50% odds on that. Especially because of, you know, the opportunity that that he's had. You know, his previous career high is 45 points, so it's not as if this would be a huge step forward for him. And again, it's the opportunity. As of now, he's going to be their 2C, and he's going to have some pretty decent wingers to play with. And especially if a guy like Kane ends up on his wing and can finish off some of those rush chances, not to mention increased power play opportunity. I would not be surprised at all if he hits 50 points. So I would say greater than 50% probability on that.
And last one, one of Atu Ratu or Max Sasson break out and give this team legitimate third line center impact, both in terms of how they perform two way and, you know, 30 plus points in terms of production.
That's a tough one. I think Ratu's your best bet for that. You're hoping for it, but I also look at the success he had down the stretch, and I don't want to get too carried away because he shot 20%. I think it was Pod Colson's rookie season. He scored 14 goals, but pretty much all of the, like, a large chunk of those were in the second half. And I remember a lot of people, myself included, got excited about, oh, like, Pod Colson's arrived as, like, a top nine everyday winger. And then, of course, the offense wasn't sustainable because it was similar to Ratu down the stretch where he was on this shooting percentage bender. So I would take below 50% odds on that, maybe around 30%. I would expect Ratu to be an everyday contributor for this team. And I wouldn't be surprised if one day he becomes a third line contributor, but I'm going to keep my expectations and sort of expect him to be, you know, closer to fourth line impact this coming season.
Hey, Harmon, really appreciate you taking the time and enjoy the off season.
Thanks, guys.
There is Harmon Dial of The Athletic joining us on Canucks Talk. Good exercise there at the end on the centers and his confidence in said centers on the Vancouver Canucks. We'll get into more on the other side. I wanted to talk a little bit about Bowen Byram and what's going on with him and potential interest around the league in the Sabres defenseman. We'll do that and more. We'll wrap up Canucks Talk on the other side. It is Josh Elliott Wolf and Thomas Drantz on Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk. Josh Elliott Wolf, Thomas Drantz. You guys call this Fakewood Mac, right?
Yes.
Is that what it is? The last edition of Fakewood Mac for the season.
I feel like it hits just as good.
It's better.
It always hits.
It always hits. Just as good as Fleetwood?
Maybe? Oh, yeah.
Wow. High praise.
Oh, I don't know about that.
High praise.
It's definitely as good as that. What was that Amazon series? Daisy Ridley in the Nine or whatever.
You lost me.
Yeah.
Do you guys not know what I'm talking about?
No. Daisy Ridley, it's like Amazon series?
Yeah, it's Daisy Jones and the Six. And they really good. You'd enjoy it. But it's like loosely based off of Fleetwood Mac. Fantastic.
All right.
Very good watch.
Okay.
Do yourselves a favor.
Sounds good. I can't say I go to Amazon for a lot of my TV watching. I've been all over the Apple stuff lately.
I will say, Drance talked about Masters of the Air a long time ago, and I took that recommendation, and it's a fantastic series on Apple.
So good.
I've been watching the Owen Wilson one, Stick.
That one's also good.
Yep. Really good.
I like that the episodes are 30 minutes.
Yeah. Very digestible.
Yes.
Easy entertainment. It's good. Okay. So, 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. You can text in. It is Canucks Talk. Coming to you live from the Kintex studio. We did get a text earlier in the show that I wanted to respond to here. So, earlier in the show, we were talking about, you know, bounce back bets. And the Canucks, especially in the center position, they're going to need some guys to pan out. And so we get a text off of the bounce back bets: Elias Pettersson returning to form, Filip Hedl staying healthy, and Thatcher Demko staying healthy. Which one of those three worries you the most?
Sorry. So give me the options again.
Elias Pettersson returning to form, Filip Hedl staying healthy, or Thatcher Demko staying healthy.
I mean, the one I'd feel most confident in is Pettersson returning to form, just because we've seen him go through inexplicable lengthy stretches of looking like a shell of himself and then coming out of it and being a 100-point player. Like, I literally have a frame of reference for it. So I've seen it. It's very rare that players as high-end as Pettersson, like, forget how to play. So I'm going to go with that as the most likely. The head injury thing with Hedl, I think I'd have to put as the least confident, just because we've seen this movie play out where a player, you know, who, like, when you sustain concussive head trauma repeatedly, you become more susceptible to it. And the amount of time that you have to miss in terms of recovering and working your way through the profile goes up. And eventually you just become susceptible to it. And I mean, we saw with like Tucker Poolman and Michael Ferland, two examples that are front of mind for me, sort of what it looks like where, you know, a guy's a durable player, always available, and all of a sudden, you know, three or four comeback attempts in a row, maybe they even make it through a game, but you get to a stretch and it's like across 12 to 16 months, this guy's tried to play seven times and hasn't finished five of those games, you know, and then it's just over. And so that level of uncertainty, I think, is the greatest of the three. And that puts Thatcher Demko sort of in the middle. I'd add that, you know, this team is pretty well positioned to insulate, as it were, Demko with Lankanen signed. Right? You can manage his minutes. You can manage his games played. Like, I think the Canucks should plan on Thatcher Demko playing 40 games and no more. I honestly think they should, like, establish a rotation and switch game after game after game. You know, like 1-1-1-1 and stick to it no matter what. Don't ride a hot hand. Don't do any of that, just because the way that the conversation will get shaped in this market, knowing, you know, I've lived through the Luongo-Schneider wars, right? Like, I've lived through the Demko-Markstrom thing, or the on and on. I mean, there's a million examples. Do you remember the Spencer Martin should play ahead of Thatcher Demko talk?
That was crazy. But that was
crazy.
The thing.
But it was serious.
And that was Spencer Martin, and this is Kevin Lankanen, who, like, maybe that's a more justifiable conversation. So I do get what you mean by the rotation might be a way to avoid the drama.
Go with the rotation and stick with it. But yeah, I mean, Demko's a really tough one for me to handicap here, just because he's dealing with an injury that we've never seen an NHL player, much less an NHL goaltender, deal with. And, you know, across 4 years, 4 years as a starter for him, he's played 64 games once, 51 games the other time. And both of the two seasons where he played more than 50 were followed up by games where he played fewer than 35, in part because he was injured late in both of those high work rate seasons. So it depends how you frame it for me with Demko, right? It's like, what's my confidence level that Demko will perform well in 40 games? Decent, you know, 50-50, mm-hmm. as confident as I ever am with the most volatile position in hockey. But if you go up to 45, if you go up to 50, right, then my confidence drops off massively. And so, you know, it's just a really difficult one to handicap. So I'll just sort of put it in the middle, partly throwing my, you know, my like hands in the air and being basically unaware of exactly how to price in the risk there.
The thing we haven't really talked about, and it's fair because it hasn't really been a concern, but I think could be a very big concern if it arises, is Kevin Lankinen's health. Like, he doesn't obviously have the history of Thatcher Demko, but if Kevin Lankinen were to get injured at any point this season, and that forces the Canucks into a situation where they have to overplay Thatcher Demko, I mean, I'm making up a hypothetical, but that would be a concern for me, is like, hey, if the Canucks are forced into a position, especially if they trade Artur Shelov, not that they necessarily have the most confidence in him, but if they're forced into a position where they have to ride Demko for 2-3 weeks, I'd be a bit concerned, because that could very quickly end up in a situation where, you know, you're worried about Demko's long-term health again. Unless he shows for an extended period of time throughout the season that, you know, if you get into February, March, maybe that's less of a concern. But if something like that were to happen early in the season, that would be a very big test, I guess, for Thatcher Demko. So hopefully that doesn't happen. Hopefully the scenario I just made up is not a reality.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, I do think just the downside risk. I talked about this a little bit on Halford and Brough, but, you know, the Demko extension to me stands sort of apart from the other deals that the Canucks did, where, you know, I think Garland is straightforward, good value. Every team should be extending players like Connor Garland when they have the chance at that level, especially a year ahead of time. The, you know, Besser extension is riskier, but, you know, I think the truth is and Harmon very, I think, aptly sort of laid this out, but the idea that Besser was no worse than the third or fourth best forward available by the time you got to July 1 made it sensible to just be like, hey, why would we go after XYZ, you know, guy who's not nearly as good as Brock Besser, when we can just lock up the better player who we're familiar with and know to be a good person? You know, I like that as a pivot, even if it wasn't plan A for the Canucks. The Demko deal, though, you know, and this is one of those sort of overall, you know, when you're doing extensions, ideally you want that extension to enhance the player's value, right? Like, in terms of their asset value, their exchange value, the way we look at value, right? And Demko on a one-year deal, I think, would have been a desirable dice roll for a lot of teams around the league. But Demko at the same cap hit as Connor Hellebuyck, you know, I think would give a lot of teams pause, especially with term attached. And so, you know, I get why the team wanted to lock up the guys that wanted to stay. And obviously, if Demko is able to stay healthy and play the way that he's capable of playing, then this logic will flip. But the Demko deal feels to me like one where, for just from the perspective of how other teams would think about it, I think it would enhance the risk of acquisition and thus lower his cost or his value sort of the day after the deal is done. And then you factor in, you know, if he leaves a game in November due to injury, I mean, there's a real world where that extension like immediately becomes a millstone, you know, like 6 weeks into the season. Right. And so when you factor in, too, the fact that Demko's not set up to play workhorse minutes, which makes it pretty difficult for him to provide surplus value, it just feels like there's a lot more downside risk on that deal than there is upside. And so that's one that I'm struggling to shake as, like, you know, what Harmon was saying. On July 1, you want to see your team avoid jumping on any grenades. And, you know, Demko's a high-end enough player that if he can stay healthy, he's going to be worth that contract. But the, I think, risk profile of that bet and the timing of it, I think it makes me sort of I mean, you heard it when we were interviewing Harmon, when he was like, they avoided jumping on any grenades. I'm like, we sure? Right? Like, are we sure?
They found
because
one
I don't
on their
think
own.
We, I don't think we can be. And that's not to pan the deal, just that we have to be clear-eyed about how volatile it is, how risky it is.
Mm-hmm. It's clearly a risk, for sure. And we'll see if it works out. I know there's been talk on other shows as well that, like, hey, if Demko can prove he can stay healthy and ends up, you know, being more of a starter, taking more of a workload as this contract goes on, does that open the door for Kevin Lankinen to be like, hey, I want to be a starter? And does that open the door for Kevin Lankinen to potentially be a trade option? And then you get into the issue of no move clauses and no trade clauses and all of that. But we'll see. We'll see how it all pans out over the next few seasons, because as of right now, that's what the Canucks are committed to in net, is these two goalies. 650-650, Dunbar Lumber text line. Keep the text coming in there. I did mention before the break, I wanted to talk about Bowen Byram, because there's been a lot of talk about him. And, you know, this off season going into it, there were kind of two schools of thoughts with offer sheets. One side was like, hey, look at Dylan Holloway and Philip Broberg, how well it worked out for the St. Louis Blues. But the other side was the 2026 first-round picks are uber valuable, and I just wonder how many teams are going to be willing to part with an unprotected first-round pick, depending on who they're offer-sheeting. And there's been a lot of talk about Bowen Byram potentially being offer-sheeted if a trade can't come together. Do you think that would be a wise move for a team like the St. Louis Blues, who are rumored to be the most interested team in Bowen Byram?
So, sorry, the reported ask is an unprotected first?
No, sorry, there's rumors of offer sheets, right? Like, there's a lot of talk around offer sheets with Byram. And
right.
Essentially, to get Byram to sign a contract, you're giving up an unprotected first, right?
Yeah, and you have to set the offer sheet at a high enough level that the Buffalo Sabres aren't just like, LOL, thank you, thanks for doing our work for
yeah,
us.
Yeah, that was super nice of you. Yeah, it would have to be, I think, at least like the low or the high end of the first round pick and third round pick compensation is just over $7 million. I assume it would have to
be 9 at least.
Yeah.
So I think that eliminates your, you know, San Jose's, Chicago's, and Anaheim's, right? Which are teams that have just a wash of cap space. I guess, like, could you see it making sense? Here, let me pitch you. What about Calgary?
If I were Calgary, I think that would be a bad move. Like, I don't know. Every year with Calgary, I'm always afraid that they're just going to bottom out in a year. And it hasn't happened.
Yeah, Dustin Wolf, though.
Dustin Wolf was really good.
I was feeling that before the Wolf emergence. You know, now I feel that. But, you know, they still rely really heavily on guys who are, like, well over 30 and young players who, you know, punched above their weight a bit last season, but that's, you know, we can't just assume linear development. So, yeah, that's an interesting one. Okay, what about Minnesota?
Minnesota, I think, would be, like, I'd be more confident in that if I were them. But, so, essentially, yeah. We're talking about, it would have to be a first, second, and third round pick, right?
Yeah,
and
so you have to be very sure
you have to
that
be
you're
so
a playoff team.
I just don't know, like, I like Byram, but I don't know if I'm that confident in Bowen Byram being worth that, especially if it's an unprotected first round pick.
You're that, right.
Thank you.
I want to say that first off before I disagree with you.
Oh, awesome.
You're right. You cannot, at this point, given how difficult it is to acquire talent, worry, in my mind, about sort of that level of uncertainty when it comes to this profile of player. And this profile of player is the profile on which the Florida Panthers dynasty is built on. Huge draft pedigree, right? Flashes of high-end performance, distressed value in and around sort of their RFA contract windows, right? Like Kachuk got bridged, they seized on that. Bennett got bridged, they seized on that. Reinhardt, you know, all of those guys are top 10 picks, regularly top 5 picks, much like Byram. We've seen Byram star in the Stanley Cup playoffs before, and he wasn't that good last year. But the talent is there, And I just think this profile of player, if you're a team that needs a defender, like, I just don't think you can look a gift horse in the mouth sometimes. This is the sort of rare profile that you need to be willing to bet big on if you're going to acquire and amass the sort of talent required to be, you know, a contender capable of closing the gap with Vegas, Carolina, and, you know, Florida, and on and on. And, you know, that's the other thing that I can't shake here. Like, the team that I'd be scared of acquiring Byram is Vegas. Because they always seem to figure stuff out. And I look at that group right now, and, you know, Pietrangelo at 35 looks like he's done for his career, which sucks because he was so awesome.
Yeah.
But Theodore's 29, Hanifin's 28. They've slowly been sort of trying to make their core younger, but Stone is 33 and Hurdle's 31 and William Carlson's 32, and they're getting long in the tooth. That shouldn't be controversial to say. They need to refresh their core group, and they specifically need more talent on the back end. They're for sure going to make the playoffs. They absolutely do not have cap space.
That's a big issue.
It's a huge issue. But they have marketable players, right? If they wanted to go 7.5, you know, I don't think they'd have a ton of problems monetizing, you know, Ivan Barbashev. Obviously, a lot of teams would fall over themselves to have a chance to acquire a player with that sort of physical profile and the ability to play a top 6 minutes. And I don't think they'd have any trouble monetizing Zach Whitecloud, right? Or Braden McNabb, frankly. Although I think McNabb has a no trade. Well, no trade. That's not a no move. Jeremy Lauzon, easily you could monetize him. And then you have $7 million in cap space with Pietrangelo on offseason LTI and become a team that can consider that sort of option. Now, they don't have their first-round pick, so they can't do the offer sheet route. But as a trade target, right, Vegas always makes it happen. And this is exactly the sort of pedigree they need to add at exactly the sort of position that they need to add it. So, that is like a team that looms in my imagination. And then more than that, just a global point. The teams that had the best summers, there's four of them, in my opinion. But three stand out. And it's Vegas, having added Mitch Marner, right? Carolina added Ehlers and Keandre Miller and locked up Logan Stankoven. And it's the Florida Panthers, right, who added, or no, didn't add anything.
Just kept everyone.
Their group together.
Yeah.
Which, you know, flies in the face of NHL history in the flat cap era, or not even the flat cap era, just the hard cap era. Stanley Cup contenders or Stanley Cup winners struggle to keep their groups together. Florida has done it. And what do those teams have in common? They all rock. They've all been in the conference final minimum three times in the last 4 years. They also, in, you know, two of three, have won a Stanley Cup in the last 5 years. Florida's won two. So I sort of look at this and think we're entering this era where the idea of just get in and anything can happen, like, it was already untrue. It was already a convenient lie. But now it's over. Like, the era of parity is over. And the rich got richer at a wild clip over the course of this summer. And so if you're going to close the gap as a middling team, I mean, you know, if you're the Canucks and you're something like the 18th or 19th best team in hockey, and you want to close the gap with the Carolinas and Vegas's and Florida's of the world, who seem to get first dibs on all the star players and also do a ton of smart stuff with extraordinary discipline, I mean, it's going to take swinging the bat. And if you get a chance to swing the bat on a guy with Byram's profile, right? High-end draft pedigree, we've seen him do it. They're mostly shaking loose because their current teams mismanaged their overall contract timeline. Like, that's just a bet. That's just a pitch you swing at every single time and swing hard. Hey, my last rant of the year.
You did it. You did it. We'll leave Woo-hoo! It there. Good job. Appreciate everyone who listened throughout the year. I've been here in spot duty at times, but I know you and Jamie have done a very, very good job and have a lot of loyal listeners who appreciate you guys. So thank you to you, Thomas Strands. Thank you to Jamie Dodd. Thank you to producer Lena Setagian as well. You guys have done a great job.
Yeah, you guys killed it all year. Thank you, guys. And thanks to the listeners, by the way. Thank you to all of the folks who text in on the 650 Dunbar Lumber text line every show, who tune in at noon to 2, a Monday to Friday, and everyone who listens to our program across, you know, whatever their preferred podcatcher is. We love you, we'll miss you, and we'll look forward to being back in September to chat hockey with you again, maybe.
Leave it on that note. I appreciate everyone texting in, everyone listening as well. Thank you today to Lena and Zach producing the show. Thank you to my co-host Thomas Drance. I've been Josh Elliott Wolf. This has been Canucks Talk, signing off for the off season on Sportsnet 650.